Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
And welcome back to the Beer Ladies podcast. I'm Lisa and I'm your host this week. And I am joined this week by my co-host, Christina. Hello, Christina.
Hi.
And we have a special guest for you for spooky season. You know, we love spooky season. You know, we go all out for this. So we are really, really excited to be welcoming friend of the podcast, Kian from Wide Atlantic Weird. Hello, Kian.
Hi, Lisa. How are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Oh, we're thrilled to have you. So friends out there on the interwebs, you need to definitely give Kian's podcast a listen. Wide Atlantic Weird covers all kinds of high strangeness, much of it Irish-based. So we love to, you know, get some of those stories out there. He's going to be sharing some fun ones with us today. So we're really looking forward to that. But before we dive in, I'm going to do our usual spiel where I say we are at Beer Ladies Pod on most of the socials. We're on Twitter, we're on Instagram, we're a little bit on TikTok. We're trying to get better about that. We're working on it. Maybe we'll get some fun stuff up as the witching hour approaches. But this is our big Halloween episode, so we're really excited about this. Maybe we'll even throw a couple ghosts on YouTube. We'll see where we get. But we also have a link tree where you can find links to all of our merch, all of our previous episodes, and you can even support the podcast over there if you want to buy us a pint. We love it when you do. We really appreciate it. But before we dive into this week's spooky season topic, we're going to go around for our usual what you drinking. So, Christina, what have you got?
So, I have a Lakata Brewing Company Community Kvike Pale Ale. George is blocking me. If you're not watching on YouTube and you're just listening, I have a green screen picture of my dog. And I will explain why in the background, but he's blocking the image. So this looks really nice. This was given to me actually at the Whiplash Craft Beer Festival. So I've been holding on to this for a while. And so thank you, Simon, for this. I'm really excited to try it and drink it because I've had a couple of their beers and I really enjoy them. So I'm super excited for this one today.
Excellent. I believe they're up north of the border, if I'm remembering correctly. So
yep, they're in Port Rush.
Oh, okay. Wonderful.
And it's, I should say, it's Lakata Brewery Co-op. So it's a co-op, which I think is really cool in particular.
That is very cool. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yep. Really, really cool. I picked this one because the colors of the can, if you can see, it's like oranges and greens and it looks very pumpkin-y. So I thought it was kind of perfect for our theme today.
Excellent. And Kian, what have you got over there?
So I've been traveling. I'm actually just barely in the door. So I've been out for the weekend and I was hoping to pick up something a little bit fancy. I did not. So I have something not too odd. This is O'Hara's Irish Pale Ale, a dry hopped IPA. It's not particularly hard to get anywhere. fairly widespread sort of an ale, but I'm fond of it. And, I just with where I was and the traveling I was doing it, I went for something fairly dependable, but yes. I do enjoy it.
Oh, absolutely. And I have Trouble Brewing's Dark Arts Porter. So this is one I do look forward to every year. Obviously, it has a little bit of a seasonal element to it in the name, but it's a delicious porter. And it's one that I first had on tap, you know, a number of years ago. I want to say maybe the first or second time I came here, long before we moved here. So it's one that I have a little bit of a fondness for from that perspective as well. So always pleased to see it back. And I really do love a nice porter this time of year. So always happy to have Trouble Brewing's Dark Arts. So with that said, again, this is spooky season. This is the Halloween episode. So again, we're really excited that this is a crossover episode as well. So that said, I'm going to say, Kian, how would you frame up this topic? I know we've been chatting about it back and forth for a while, but it's high strangeness. I'm going to start with that. But what would you say beyond that?
I think we're going to talk about ghost stories. I think it'd be fun to make connections and differences between the sort of culture of ghost stories in the different countries that we know. I've spoken before with on the show with my friend and friend of the show, Victoria Pearson, about the difference between ghost stories in Ireland and England and how they serve different functions, how the different religions of the countries means that ghost stories perform different needs and functions, I think, in society. I'm interested in hearing about comparisons to the US and abroad. There are a lot of stories which, you know, transferred across these countries. But I think the differences between them are interesting as well. So it might be fun to choose a genre of ghost story and then see how they are different or similar across different countries. That could be one way of coming at this.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think this is going to tie into tangentially, but there's still a tie in here to some of the work Christina's doing, because she's doing some books on brewing in the UK and then brewing in Ireland. What's similar? What's different? So again, there's just that theme there of some of these things are very, you know, very much a shared thing, and some are very, very different in how they play themselves out.
Absolutely. And brewing is really tied up in Irish folklore, for example. We're not going to talk about that too much today, but that is just something like I've noticed from my research. There's lots and lots and lots of brewing and beer and ale and just very much within the threads, like just the very depth of it in Irish folklore. So
absolutely. Absolutely. So yeah, so Kian, take it away. Where do you want to begin? I know you've got windows open to figure out where to dive in.
So I thought we'd pick a fairly common ghost story from these isles, which is the Black Dog, sometimes called the Black Shuck. And this is a story usually associated with England and the UK, I will say. Most books you find will feature stories from England. And I think the sort of folkloric origins of this are well chronicled in that part of the world. And obviously a book came out in recent years by Mark Norman about the Black Dog, which is probably the most recent kind of comprehensive take on this. Not so much has been written about it in Ireland, though there is a chapter on it in that book. But I'm just one interested in seeing how these things show up in different places. So in England, what you normally hear is in any number of books about folklore, we'll have a chapter about the Black Dog. And the Black Dog is a spiritual being. It's not a cryptozoological thing usually, although some people have written interesting stuff about that element as well. Yeah. But it is a ghost or a demon or a supernatural entity that appears to you when you are walking on a lonely street or a lonely moor or a lonely laneway and you're on your own and it's nighttime and it's dark. And there are versions of the story where the dog is demonic. So sometimes it is huge and has one eye or has, you know, flames coming from its mouth or something, you know, overtly frightening. In other cases, the dog is a helpful spirit who appears next to you and walks with you through an area which is dangerous, either because of, you know, bandits or brigands in the old days, or there is some sort of spiritual danger. You're passing by a graveyard that has a negative spirit and the dog walks with you and appears out of nowhere to walk with you past this dangerous place and then disappears afterwards. Those are some of the variants with which the dog appears in England. There's also variants where the dog is a family curse, you know, which shows up over the generations, which is most people know, of course, from Conan Doyle's The Hound of the Baskervilles, which was partly inspired at least by visits he made to Dartmoor in the southwest. I went searching for Irish takes on this, and surprisingly enough, they have elements in common and they have elements that are quite different. So on Dukas.ie, which is a wonderful repository of, I'm sure you're familiar with this one, I'm sure some listeners will too, it's a collection of written documents, often from the earlier mid-20th century, where people were asked, sometimes in schools, to record stories that they knew themselves or stories that they had been told by parents or grandparents. And so this was a record of like a then living tradition, I suppose. And you get very interesting things. So this is a story recorded in 1937, just called The Black Dog, from the county of Kilkenny, and indeed from Kilkenny town or Kilkenny city. The story goes like this. The story is said to be true, although it is related differently by everyone. However, I will take the one that belongs to our family, or at any rate, the one that my father told me, and set before you the story as simply as possible. And there is a church in the city of Kilkenny which once belonged to the Catholics, but during one of the strifes of which Irish history is made up, the Protestants captured it and have held it ever since. And there is a graveyard attached to it, which is the resting place of ancient Catholics as well as Protestants. It is said that each night at the midnight hour, a black dog as big as a donkey used to gallop through Michael St. Wolfstone Street, the Dublin Road, and down Magdalen Street. Any person who is unlucky enough to meet this monster will never have an easy mind as long as he or she lives. He spits fire in two long flames from his mouth and does the most frightful, and at this point I need to turn the page. Yeah. Does the most frightful dances, his two large fiery eyes fixed on them. Then he will stand on his hind legs and tumble somersaults until they have the courage to pass by him. On one occasion, an old piper named Cuaic O'Leary was on his way to play his bagpipes at a dance when he saw this horrible creature. Cuaic, who was a man of great courage, had often heard of this ghost. He immediately shouldered his pipes, filled his bag, blew his drones, and blew so loudly as to imitate the cry of a donkey. The ghost's eyes grew more fiery and as large as pot lids, but old Cuaic was not frightened. Suddenly the ghost made a leap past Cuaic and ran for the churchyard faster than the devil ran through Athlone. Cuaic continued on his way to the dance playing The Wind That Shakes the Barley, which was Cuaic's favorite tune. The ghost was never seen or heard of since the night it encountered old Cuaic O'Leary, the pipe player.
Wow. And we've spoken on previous our previous spooky episodes a little bit about Kilkenny town and some of the because that's the only place we find actual witch burning. Well, actual in air quotes, witch burning. Mm-hmm. Someone does get burned. They're not a witch, but you know, there we are. But oh my gosh, that's fascinating. And for anyone who's not checked out Dukas as a resource, it's phenomenal. They've done such amazing work to preserve and digitize this stuff. And it's just really, really, really just a huge resource. So, wow.
Yeah. So that's interesting to me. It's more like the, you know, the people say this thing happened story rather than, you know, an actual sighting, which is a division I think folklorists and people who chronicle ghost stories tend to make. But interesting how, and you know, there's this folkloric element where a character, sometimes a fiddle player, you know, or some sort of joke telling person or a storyteller or a bard or a fiddle player meets the devil or the pooka on a dark night and gets one over on him. And this story has an element of that for sure. And it's quite different in tone to the black dog stories that you get from the UK. Which is
I think it's interesting because you get the sort of fire and all of those elements that you get pieces of, but it's a very different outcome, first of all. And it feels like a different I hate to say it, but vibe as well. It's just kind of a different tone to it. And I guess Christina, you probably get this all the time with George spitting fire at you if he's not been fed, and you know.
Yeah, I mean, I was gonna say the whole concept of the black dog is a family curse. I mean, honestly, like I totally vibe with that. No, I'm just kidding. Like I love my dog, but like look at his face; he's so cute. So if you can't, if you're just listening, I have a black dog called George. Who is an absolute delight and absolutely to give you an idea, his nickname is Demon, so I do call him Demon and he answers to that. So I do think that this kind of fits into the theme. But you know, something that I have noticed since having a black dog is that people are nervous about black dogs, like and black dogs and black cats are less likely to be adopted, I think I read. So it does seem like that is not just in like that folklore has informed people's interactions with certain kinds of dogs.
Yeah. Well, and that's interesting too. I feel like, especially like where you are in East Wall too, you do have families who have been there for generations and might, you know, there might be a little more continuity of some of those traditions than there maybe in other parts of Dublin, but I don't know.
My neighbors seem to like him, so.
But that's good. Yeah.
Yeah, he's not very big. I will say he's definitely not the size of a donkey. He's a little guy. But yeah, no, he's a delight. I love him so much. But yeah, he's funny. I don't know. I don't know 100% if the black dog, black cat thing is true with terms of adoption, but I have read it some places, but I have not seen any like actual statistics on that. Just yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I have definitely heard that people are a little more nervous about that. So I don't know, Kian, if you have anything.
I've heard that for the first time only this week. I was with a friend who has a black cat and they said this to me, and hearing it back now, it does have a sort of an urban legend vibe to it. It sort of sounds like one of those, like, you know, that when the full moon comes out, you know nurses will tell you that, you know, people are a little bit crazier. It just has that vibe, but I have no idea. I wonder what the statistics, whether they would hold that out or not. It's certainly a possibility.
Yeah. Now, I wonder too, just thinking about some of the things that sort of, and I'm not sure if it's as much with dogs, but I feel like, you know, we no longer have the kind of thing where ghosts that appear on the road, for example, whether they show up initially as like a donkey or the shagged foal or things like that, but then they turn into different things. They turn into a hay bale. They turn into like all sorts of different stuff. I feel like that's a tradition that's not around anymore. I don't know if that intersects with black dogs as much, or if they're still kind of their own thing. I get the sense from the ones I've read that they're kind of their own thing. They don't go through this kind of metamorphosis that some of these other creatures do. And I think, you know, like the puka is one of those that can change kind of their appearance and that kind of thing. But again, I feel like they're kind of separate beings, if you like.
Yeah, and I always get the vibe in some stories that the puka is a distinct creature of its own. And then in other stories, it's kind of just a name for like the devil or, you know, a generic demonic sort of presence.
Yeah.
And therefore, it's traditionally said the puka usually appears as a horse, but he can appear as a donkey or whatever else he wants to be. And then in Scottish folklore, you've got kelpies, which are horse-like in some iterations. And, you know, there's a lot of crossover there. And I don't think that some of the ideas we have about what a particular creature is called and what it does is because of these folklorists who would have gone out in Victorian times and laid them down. And therefore they said, this is what the Kelpie is. And so, you know, that's when it's set. You know, it's usually, I think that a lot of these are set a lot later than we actually think. And a common one is the death coach, which is an Irish tradition. Mm-hmm. And I have friends who live in North Tipperary, and there's a death coach account associated with their road in rural Tipperary. And you'll always see it referred to in folkloric books of the early 20th century as the coach de Bower, which literally translated means the deaf coach, which makes me think that some, you know, English speaking folklorist must have gone out into the provinces, you know, circa 1870 or 1880, and had a translator with him speaking to Irish speaking people, and somebody misheard something.
Oh,
and so you'll always see it in books, and this was passed on without anybody noticing, and you'll still see it written in books as the coach de Bower, which literally means the deaf coach,
right?
Where instead of the deaf coach, which would be, you know, on coach de Marv or coach de Marva or something like that, which that's my supposition, but I can't imagine how else this mistake got perpetuated.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, that's interesting. And again, see, I'm going to do a thing. I'm tying it all together. This is like, where I know, Christina, we eventually need to get Maren Dinley on, where you get people who don't know what they're looking at, but because she knows brewing, she can look at things archaeologically and be like, oh, this is what's happening. And people just haven't picked up on this. And again, similarly, like if you can speak Irish, you can be like, well, wait, that doesn't add up. And it's something that should be very simple, but unless you have someone who knows, these things get, and like you said, they get perpetuated and then they kind of morph into other
they become things. They become the accepted version.
And
sometimes they're not that old, you know. Some of this stuff comes from the 30s and 40s, and we think it was this age-old thing when it was, you know, something which might have been quite broad and had lots of different forms would have been codified by some folklorist, you know, I suppose some of these guys. So a lot of the stories that I think you guys will know, and Lisa, that I know you'll have in your books, will come from people like, a lot of them were clergymen or, you know, Anglo-Irish kind of upper class fellows who just had an interest in folklore and mythology. And obviously Eliot O'Donnell was a famous one. And there's another fellow called Reverend John Seymour. And these guys wrote books about Irish ghost stories. you know, in at the turn of the century, and their stories are still being cribbed. Like, if you pick up a generic book of Irish ghost stories today, and you actually deep dive into like where are they getting this stuff from, a lot of it's just it's taken from these books from 100 years ago and more. And I found, so I have a book called Irish Ghosts by J. Anus Corcoran, and this is relatively recent. This is 2002, but like everything he says, it's fun, it's interesting. Yeah. But almost all of his good stories are ripped from like Eliot O'Donnell and Seymour. You know, it's funny to trace where these things come from because they still show up in books.
They do. Yeah, these things get sort of repeated, like you say, again and again. You'll see slight variation here and there, or I think too, like the number of times. I don't know, this one's not a black dog, but the number of times that, you know, the devil's playing cards and they see the cloven hoof, and I mean, it's at the Hellfire Club, it's at Loftus Hall, it's at, you know, anywhere, like greatest hits, you know.
Then it becomes a question of like what matters. Like, does what one, like, if it's been retold, like, I mean, now it's part of folklore, like what, like we have so many modern urban legends, like what is the importance of provenance? And I'm not saying that it isn't important, but I'm just saying, you know, like, it's like, we talk about St. Bridget a lot here, and a lot of that stuff was written 150 years after she, you know, she was dead, and none of it comes from any writings of her own lifetime, but it's still a really important part of Irish folklore history and Irish history in general. So I just wondered if Lisa and Kian, if you have any thoughts on like why this matters, and does it matter, and does it maybe matter a little bit in some circumstances and not so much in other things? Like, what's the context here? Just curious what you think.
Oh, it's a really good question, because I do think it matters, but you're right, it matters in different ways. It's you know, I mean, I think in all of these there's almost always this kind of class element of trying to unpack, you know, are we looking at something where they're like, oh, the, you know, the poor untutored, you know, unwashed, you know, people believe this, or is it like we've gone out because they are the last, you know, sort of preservers of this tradition? And there's, you get both extremes, I think, that are both interesting, but probably both wrong. So it's, and then how do you meet in the middle? I don't know, Kian, if you have thoughts.
I mean,
on
I have a great love for that sort of M.R. James style.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Educated antiquarian, you know, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, goes out into the country and uncovers some mystical artifact or finds some ancient tradition or whatever. And, you know, I think that story comes to us through the writing of people like, Eliot O'Donnell, like, you know, and so we have this trope, the stereotype of the educated person who comes from the town, goes into the countryside, hears what the local people are saying, and then interprets it back to them, which is what, you know, largely British folklorists were doing.
Yeah.
You know, in 1920s, 1930s, with you know, beliefs in like pagan survivals and stuff, and they were going out to these villages and telling people, "Oh, your local little cute tradition is actually this age-old celebration of, you know, the goddess of the harvest or whatever." And the local people were like, "No, this is just a thing we do for a bit of a laugh, and like invented by my grandfather two generations ago." And these folklorists are like, "No, you don't understand your own tradition. I will interpret this for you."
Yes.
And so there is a class element, yeah, and there's always a colonial element as well, mm-hmm. where, you know, we can say this, that it's a bit of fun, but then same thing's going on where people from this part of the world go off to other parts of the world and interpret other groups of people, interpret their stuff back to them and say, you know, oh, let us tell you what this is really about. And then, there are cases where British people are doing this to themselves, where, you know, the city people are doing it to the country people or whatever. So, it's fun. We have created this version of what we think the Irish or the British countryside is like and what we think these beliefs are, but there's a dark underbelly to it as well. It's kind of hard for me to separate it from some of the colonial thinking as well.
You're dead right, and it shouldn't be. I think that's a really important point to bring up, sort of, especially the sort of splaining, I guess, back to people and like explaining their own traditions to them, which is, oh my god, the condescension there. Unbelievable.
It's just funny, like, and Ronald Hutton talks about this a lot in his books, but the upper class folklorists desperately wanted these things to mean something that was important to them, that they were obsessed with, you know, Britishness or Irishness in the case of nationalists in this country at the same time. And that everyone wanted it to mean a particular thing that was so deeply tied to identity. And I think archaeology and anthropology are more, they're more in danger of being sucked into mysticism and woo than almost any other academic disciplines, because they're so tied to identity, aren't they? And we think that our relationship to the land, our relationship to folklore, our relationship to you know, these age-old traditions that we desperately want to have been the same for thousands of years, you know, to make, because people were trying to find out, what did it mean to be English? What did it mean to be Irish? What did it mean to be German? The Brothers Grimm were writing at this time, you know, as late as, I've said this before, but as late as the 1940s and 50s, Tolkien is writing because he desperately believes England doesn't have a central myth that other countries do. And that's part of his motive for writing Lord of the Rings, is to give England this myth that he feels is lacking, whereas, you know, the Irish have latched onto the Tán and Cú Chulainn and stuff, and the Germans have the Brothers Grimm, and they all think that, like, somewhere out there in the provinces in the countryside is the true essence of Germanness or Irishness, or, and so these folk tales come loaded with meaning, you know, and it means something different to the people in the towns than it does to the people in the city, which is really interesting.
Yeah, and there's always that, even if you look at someone like, again, I think she doesn't get enough credit, but, you know, Oscar Wilde's mother, who you know, she's publishing Esperanza,
yes.
But, you know, she's going out, she's looking for these things. But again, it's in a very specific, you know, mm-hmm. there's an agenda there, which I think, to be fair to her, I think she does declare more than some people of her era did. But it's also, I think, you know, again, possibly because she was a woman, people could be like, oh, that's just a fun thing she does, you know, and kind of hand wave it away. But, you know, that's a big thing I think you see in any kind of folklore collecting, is a lot of the things are collected by women, but the important men are doing the sort of codifying of these things. But again, like, the women are doing very specific sort of, there are choices made there in kind of what they're repeating, what they're not. And often you even see cases where they will kind of, you know, they'll collect the story, but because the person sort of told it, you know, too well and in not enough of a kind of yokel way, it'll be related in a dialect that no one actually spoke. And it's like, what's happening?
I think the key figure we're dancing around here is Margaret Murray, who,
I mean,
you know, made her way in a man's world in more ways than one. And you
absolutely
know, someone to be admired for many things.
Yes.
But in the field of archaeology.
Yeah, if not 100%.
Interpretation of folklore.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, again, and I know, Christina, we've talked about this too at other times, is that, you know, archaeologists like to go into fields they don't really know anything about and just jump in. And, you know, that's, I think, a good example too, and just be like, well, it all kind of supports my idea. But you know, it doesn't mean they were bad at archaeology, but, you know, when sometimes when you go into something else, it's not really your thing. You don't know the backstory. So.
Well, and I think that that's a really interesting thing about, like, oral histories. Like, it's, oral histories are a really important resource, and they're excellent and so important, but lots of problems come in, but Kian and Lisa, like you're saying, when they start being written down, because a lot of times the people that are writing them down are not part of the in-group, as you were saying. So they're part of the out-group. So they don't know the tones. They don't understand maybe the sarcasm or the in jokes within the community. And so even if they are doing a really faithful writing down of the thing, they don't understand all of these intrinsic, not, you know, exclusively, not this, like, under language, like, they're not understanding all of this context, because they simply cannot understand this. Even if they have the best translator, even if they speak the same language, they're just not going to pick up on these cultural traditions, because they just simply aren't from that culture. And so that means that no matter what, it's not going to be a faithful retelling necessarily, even if they are trying their best. And that's something, like, as a historian, that we encounter all the time when we're working with folklore or any history, any writing, because we can't possibly understand what the person who was writing it was meaning by this, or if they were serious, or if they simply made things up because it was amusing to them to do so. And their readers might have understood this, but we now, however many years down the road, don't understand that, because we're just so far removed. So I think that's a really interesting thing that you're both bringing up, like, who is saying this and who is then writing it down, and all of these, like, layers and things get missed perhaps in this way. I think that's just really interesting.
Yeah. And it happens across, like, it happens with folklore, it happens with music, it happens with with sport. You know, Ireland in the late 19th century is reinventing a new image for itself, a new way of thinking about itself, a new identity. And so you get the GAA, the Gaelic Games, is formed, and, you know, organizations for codifying the Irish language are forming. And, you know, as soon as something ceases to be oral and starts to be written down, it becomes like museumified or whatever. Mm. And Irish music goes from being this, a thing that you do in the pub, a thing that you do for dancing, a thing that you do to have a laugh. And then they say, no, we have to be this great ancient culture, like the, you know, I mean, the a lot of it's being done by Anglo-Irish people, you know, Douglas Hyde and these, who are great nationalists, but they came from that background. And so they're obsessed with the ancient Greeks, the ancient Romans, the ancient Egyptians. And they're thinking, oh, we need to make Irish Ireland like one of these great civilizations. So what do? We take the pub music and we elevate it. And we turn it into, you know, cultists, and these organizations are formed that, you know, let's have a structured system of learning it the way we do with classical music. Let's have concerts the way we do with classical music, you know, which is wonderful. And it's amazing, but it's different. You change.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. And you certainly see that too in England with the, you know, the English Folk Song Folk Dance Society. For years, they wouldn't let, you know, common people into the library, yes, which is... Yes. Fascinating, even though that was who they were meant to be.
The folk can collecting. Come to the folk dance.
Yeah, exactly. Now, fortunately, that's very different now, and it's great that they have someone amazing like Eliza Carthy, you know, in charge, who can, you know, who can be like, no, that's not how we roll. But, you know, for decades, really, up until Shirley Collins, you know, came in and was like, wait, what? You know, this was very like, no, only if you were, you know, an academic or, you know, have the right credentials can you look at what the folk did. And that's, and again, like you said, that happens everywhere where this starts to become sort of codified, where it's become studied, and where people, again, want these things to have this maybe broader meaning that a lot of times, and again, I always say this about, you know, archaeology, is that, you know, I think we really underestimate in the archaeological record, like the extent to which people might have just done something because it was fun or cool. And, you know, but that's not ritual, that's not contributing to a, you know, greater thing. And I know, Christina, you're making the face, you're like, yes.
Yeah, well, no, because like Lisa and I joke about this all the time, that like, you know, when we die, we're going to make these ridiculous burials, and we're going to try to get like, you know, 150 people. And this is an original, we've seen other people make these sorts of comments, it's common among archaeologists, just so that way, you know, 250 years, 500 years were someone's thesis. But like, we can't be, and even though there's a lots of like archaeologists joking about this now, there has to have been people in the past that were like, you know what?
Absolutely.
I'm going to do this because it's funny.
Yeah. I'm going to put a noose around my neck and die in a bog. So they'll think it's ritual.
Well, you know, you really don't know, you know, it like... Sometimes we ascribe to ritual what should simply just be like an isolated case of, you know, this person was really attached to this particular thing, and his family was like, or her family or their family was just, sure, we're going to put that in there. Right. Now, that's not to say that there's definitely clear, like I wrote my thesis on burial rituals. And so trust me, there's rituals. But for you know, for that, there are absolutely people who just did things because that's what they wanted to do in the circumstance. And like, sometimes we don't need to ascribe all of everything to it. But yeah, that's a whole nother, you could write a library about.
Oh, absolutely. Arguments. All right. I'm gonna get us back to another spooky story. So what's another good story we should dive into? Because again, spooky season. We wanna stay on target.
We do. Okay, let's move from ghostly dogs to ghostly cats, right? Ooh. So
I will say that's perfect timing because my cat has just appeared behind the screen over here. So well done.
So outside of Dublin, there is the Hellfire Club, which is a a stone building. It was a hunting lodge associated with rich upper class sort of Dublin 1%ers from the 16, 1700s. And they would go up on the hill, looking down upon the city, and has its own collection of ghost stories associated with it. But at the base of the hill is a more modern building called Killicky House. Now, for anyone who's a fan of the 1970s Osborne ghost books, I think
which are the best. They're the best.
Which are amazing, and got many a young person into ghost stories, and they were reprinted again at some point in the 90s, which is probably why I know them, but they're wonderful. The illustrations are amazing. And they just kind of, they didn't go easy on kids in those days, did they?
No, no, they are hardcore. They're just straight in.
There's really horrific stuff in there. And I was haunted as a kid by this one illustration. There was a double page spread in the Osborne book of Spectres and Ghosts and Haunted Houses. And there was a page about a poltergeist invasion of a place called Killickey, somewhere in Ireland. There was very little text on this. Was invaded by a poltergeist that took the form of like legions of flying hats. And there's this one illustration of of like all these kind of stereotypical hats, like, you know, like central casting central casting hats. There's like a deerstalker and a maid's hat and a, you know, a whatever, a top hat, and, you know, all these stereotypical things, and they're like flying in the window and spooking all these people, and I thought this was terrifying. And later in life I went looking this up, and I couldn't find it anywhere. I couldn't find out where this came from. I didn't even know, was this the Killickey house from outside Dublin near the Hellfire Club? I presumed it must be, but it wasn't clear. Now my friend Victoria Pearson has done some reading on this, and I think might have found the origin of this story, which is great. And it's, I will do an episode on my show with her about this, I promise.
That'd be great.
But, and full credit to her. But this, I think, comes from a book called Psychic Phenomena in Ireland by a rather forgotten writer named Sheila St. Clair, who was collecting stories like this in the early 1970s. I believe this book is from 1972. And so there's various ghost stories associated with Killickey House. It's still there. You can go and see it today. And when I was there, I went with her, and we a couple of years ago. And they have a lovely little fireplace in this dining room, and you can sit in and look at, there's a painting of a black cat on the wall. It's quite famous. And this is the ghostly cat that appeared to people in the house, which you can read about anywhere. That story is quite well known. But this thing with the poltergeist and the hats,
Weird and specific. I love it.
It's so weird and specific, but I couldn't find it anywhere. And so here's the quote that Victoria found in the Sheila St. Clair book. It says, And this is her, she went to visit Killickey House at some point, I think in the early 70s, shortly after the happenings. And it says, in the same newspaper account, Mrs. O'Brien, so this is about an artist moves into the house in the late 60s and is doing it up, is getting some work done. And the builders and the artist are both reporting weird things happening. Mrs. O'Brien told how she and the gardener had sometime previously disinterred some skeleton remains in the grounds. They were then reburied and the grave blessed. Well, you know, sounds like you're trying to take some measures there to prevent sort of poltergeist type stuff, but it wasn't enough. But
as you do, you don't call anyone. You're just like, it's fine.
It says, certainly there is much of interest to be found at Killickey House, and one must always bear in mind the close proximity of the ruins of the Hellfire Club. In fact, one or two people in the district told us they had seen what might appear to be a latter-day coven functioning in the vicinity.
Of course they did.
But what excited me the most was the phenomena of the caps. During the manifestation, caps and hats would be found in odd locations all over the house. Sometimes the caps contained old coins, among them a Polish crown and a farthing. Also shown to me was the kind of cap with strings that an old lady might have worn around the turn of the century. Another was a sunbonnet, and there were numerous children's knitted caps and bonnets. It is hard to say why the phenomena at Killickey House were so varied in nature. As in the case of Guildhall, there may be due in some part to the fact that occult practices are known to have taken place near the house, or the building and decorating work may have activated certain vibrations.
There you go.
And a member of the O'Brien family may have been an unconscious focal point. She doesn't say it was a teenage girl, but you can tell she's going there.
where is the poltergeist getting the hats, right?
Like, you know, like when they throw stones, you know where they're getting the stones,
right? Or nails, spot. or something falls off the wall, or whatever. But where are they getting the hats?
it does in the Borley Rectory case, in Harry Price's books, which was a very famous ghost story and would have been well known, I suspect, to someone like Sheila St. Clair in the 1970s. He writes that a mysterious brown coat appears, I think, in the house.
Oh, yes.
And like, yes, things like a ring and coins and things that nobody claimed to own seem to have manifested. Now, those are quite minor by comparison to like hats everywhere. But I wonder if something like that is where she's getting it from. I don't know.
Oh, my goodness. That's fascinating. And I'll say a slight aside on Borley Rectory, because again, like back in the day, I assumed I was the only weirdo who knew about these things as a kid, and who's into reading like the Osborne books and all of those things. But when I was in high school, two girls in my class, their parents got married, and it was a big, like, angry Brady Bunch kind of situation. And it kicked off all kinds of, again, alleged kind of poltergeist behavior in their now shared house. And one, like, the thing that freaked everyone out was that there was writing on the wall. It was like, oh, help me, you know, whomever. And at the time I was like, it's just like Morley Rectory. It's like Marianne. Oh my God. And it never occurred to me that maybe someone else had also read the same thing. And like, literally until like 2 weeks ago, did it occur to me that maybe they had also read this, and that had they been like, we're going to do this, and we are going to like act out all of our weird stuff about this new blended family with, you know, tried and true methods. But again, like, one of those things. So, but yeah, where did the hats come from? And I love, just again, like I keep saying, the specificity of the hats, and the hats, like, you know, it's like, you know, here's a pirate hat, here's, you know, whatever they are, like, they're so like from central casting, like you say.
She seems to be implying that the hats were just found in weird places, but in the Osborne book, like, they're flying in the window animated by themselves, which is way scarier.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I'm months looking at things to try and find out where this has come from. So weird.
I think I have this book too. I'm going to go do some digging, because I think I have the Sheila Sinclair book. I have at least one book by her. I'm sure it's, oh gosh, I knew she probably had a couple. Like, these people often had, you know, a whole series of them.
Here's a question. Does anyone have a Phantom Hitchhiker story local to either where you are now or where you've lived in the past?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I've got weird ones. Like, I have like your standard, like your Resurrection Marys, but Hawaii has its own, like, Madame Pele is her own Phantom Hitchhiker category. She's like her own thing. This. Well, I'll do it quickly, but then I know Christina's got some good ones. But so in Hawaii, again, you get a very different category of ghosts, because you get the sort of native Hawaiian ones, you get Japanese ones, and they kind of blend together in different ways. But the interesting thing is, people will see either an old woman walking along the side of the road in Hawaii, or they'll see a very young woman, and she's always described in kind of the same way. She'll have, like, if it's the young woman, she'll have long, you know, very dark hair, she'll have blazing eyes, there's always this kind of element of fire. Or if she's the old woman, she'll have kind of bedraggled hair, but you never, ever, ever pass her by. You always pick her up, because bad things happen if you don't. And even if she just wants to go a couple blocks, you know, and she will do some of the semi-standard Phantom Hitchhiker stuff of, you know, either disappearing or, you know, whatever, but she'll almost always give some kind of prophecy beforehand, like, oh, X volcano is going to erupt on whatever day, or, you know, that kind of thing. But if you do pick her up, you have good luck. And so people want to, you know, be in, you know, good graces with her. And if you don't, then, like, you have messed up. This is very, very bad for you. But there are some really interesting stories, and people even have her, like, they have a whole collection of some of these books from Hawaii. And it's just fascinating how it is different from your other Phantom Hitchhiker ones, and that, you know, there's a kind of transactional piece to it, where you will be kind of rewarded if you pick her up, versus like your kind of standard ones where it's just like, oh, they disappear. So there's a, you know, again, you want to, like, be on your guard. But you know, Christina, you've got a couple.
Oh, I mean, I don't really have any specific ones, except that I went to university in West Virginia, and West Virginia being home to lots of folklore. Of course, famously the Mothman, which is a cryptid.
Of course.
So it's a little bit kind of off what we're talking about,
but like, awesome. Yeah.
But yeah, very, very interesting. There's a museum, and a couple of my friends are like really interested in the lore and everything. But like, West Virginia has a lot of legends about the mountains and things to do and not do in the forest. And I'm sure a lot of that comes from various Native American tribes that are around there, and their folklore. It's not necessarily from people that have colonized there, though I do think that there's sort of an influence from sort of both peoples that sort of has merged. But there are I am not an expert in this, so there are people that know way more about the history than this. I just went to university there and was told things, and some of the things just sound similar to stories that I've heard from my friends who live in different places. But yeah. there's definitely like lots of folklore about hitchhikers, which I've heard all over. I've lived a bunch of different places, and I've heard definitely that kind of folklore, you know, don't pick people up on the side of the road. Obviously, if you're a woman, because they'll murder you, but like, right. Also just the lore of, yeah, you put them in the car and then they disappear. Or there's like the woman in white, which I think is also really a really common one I've heard of lots of. But like, yeah. And then I lived in a haunted house when I was there for a point in time. So that was fun.
just throwing that in there. Just, yeah.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't, yeah, but I, yeah, there was something in that house.
Yeah. I mean, and again, like living in the UK in the 1990s, I felt like it got into the popular consciousness with like Bluebell Hill was a huge thing, but again, this is kind of the worst, but also the best is I got so into, when Richard and Judy on This Morning got into the Ruskington horror, and you can, it's all on YouTube now. It is phenomenal. And they're still writing about it now, you know, in the Fortean Times. And it's just like, it was fascinating. I can remember like having watched when it was like first happening, like in real time, people calling in and being like, it's this stretch of road in Lincolnshire. This happened. And this is less a hitchhiker and more someone in the road who just like, you know, disappears in front of the car, or they think is hit by the car, all of these things. And I'm like, but again, I'm curious, I'd be curious how it's different here. I don't know.
I mean, I have a very specific one about outside Cork City. There is Photo Wildlife Park.
And, oh, yes.
It's a wildlife park, but it's a large estate like from back in the day, and it's surrounded by this old stone wall marking the edges of the estate. Now, right. It's a fairly main road goes past it, so it's not by any means an isolated area, but when you leave the main roundabout coming out of Cork City, you are briefly in an area where there's a lot of tree cover. It's a little bit darker. The road is fast and you're unlikely, it's not exactly the spookiest place ever, but you are briefly in a covered area with a lot of shade and shadow. And if you were late at night and there wasn't anybody driving around, I suppose it could be a little bit spooky, but like it's well known. And many people have told me this over the years, that there is a story that at this very specific point, and like people can usually point to exactly where this is as you come around the bend on the outside of this stone wall, there is a ghost girl hitchhiking. Oh. And if you don't stop and pick her up, and this sounds similar to your story, you drive on, the next time you look in your rear mirror, you will see her sitting in the seat behind you.
Oh,
and she's angry because you didn't pick her up. So she gets into the car anyway, but this time she's angry. And the story kind of ends there. There's no retribution. I'm not sure what it's supposed to do for you. So it feels kind of like a jump scare from a film rather than a folklore story. But I've heard this one many times over the years, and it's just interesting how specific in space it is.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. Yeah, I do love it if they're you know, associated with a very specific place. Like a lot of the Hawaiian ones are not. They'll kind of move around. But something like a Resurrection Mary in Chicago will be, you know, with the cemetery there, and, you know, very specific and very, again, formulaic in the way the story works. But I think that's another reason I love the Ruskington horror one, because it's such a weird story that it doesn't kind of fit a lot of these things. People will try to tie it in with like, oh, the American air base was near there, and maybe there's this and that, and you're like, but the stories don't really match up. They're just a little more strange. So it's again, I love a story that's just got the high strangeness that you can't really explain, and it's just it leaves you with that sort of tingly feeling where you're like, I don't know what's happened here, it's weird. So yeah, I don't know. Christina, was your haunted house like that?
Oh yeah. And like, and I also find it so interesting that like different cultures tell you different things. Well, I guess different stories, how to like deal with these certain things. Like some of them are like, absolutely under no circumstances do you even recognize them. Like if you didn't see it, you didn't hear it, you didn't do anything, just keep walking past it. And then in other circumstances, you must acknowledge, you must, you know, speak with or whatever, or then you'll have something bad happen. So then you're kind of like, well, what do I do? What do I do?
Which one is this? Yeah.
Wait, which one are you?
Yeah. Oh, sorry, Kian, you were saying, yeah.
No, I like that. I'm thinking about high strangeness, and I found a story in the J. Ines Corcoran book, which to me doesn't fit any category. It doesn't sound like any of these. Yeah. I'm presuming he's getting this from, you know, one of these older early 20th century writers. He's not clear on this occasion. I haven't tracked it down, but this is so out there. And I wonder if anyone has any thoughts on this. He calls it the Bog of Allen Shapes, okay? Which is kind of indistinct already. So he says, the Bog of Allen is a large bog in the center, in the Midlands. And he says, not all apparitions are instantly recognizable. In the dreary, featureless flats of the Bog of Allen, especially in the days before much of it was drained and reclaimed for cultivation, there were strange manifestations. Vague, indistinct shapes could sometimes be seen by travellers, only a little darker than the grey sky itself, lingering among the peaty pools and black sumps of the surface. From a distance, they looked like human figures, and so got a bad name for luring unsuspecting wayfarers into the treacherous depths of the bog. Here, there were soft areas of mud of unknown depth where they would be swallowed up and die a hideous choking death as the slime engulfed them. But it may be that there was no such intention. He tells a story about a traveler making his way across the bog, and it starts raining, and he pops into like an empty hut, you know, maybe a leftover famine house or something like that. And as he's looking out through the doorway, it says, at one point on the stream bank, he saw what appeared to be a dark patch of haze like fog, and yet not like fog. Knowing that the bogland had strange atmospherics of his own, he was not unduly puzzled, and yet it gave him a somewhat eerie feeling. The feeling was greatly intensified when he saw that the hazy patch was moving over the surface of the bog in his direction. There was a sense of purpose in that steady movement that made him feel something was directing its course straight at him. So the shapes kind of approach him and kind of move through him and then make their way harmlessly on across the bog. Very interesting stuff. Doesn't sound like a regular ghost story.
Yeah.
It sounds like something John Keel would write, isn't it? Right. Talking about high strangeness, something that has no obvious explanation. I found that very interesting.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, where it's like, it could be swamp gas, but you feel like someone who was could explain that if it would be a little clearer. And oh, that's a weird one. Yeah. Yeah, again, I love those that it's just like, you could kind of explain it this way, but it still doesn't quite fit, you know.
It doesn't sound like any regular ghost story. There's something existential. It's almost Lovecraftian. It's just like something that you couldn't possibly understand because it doesn't behave according to the regular rules that we expect. And so, you know, there's nothing nice and tidy about it. All the other ghost stories in that book are like, you know, it turns out that somebody died at this spot and that explains the thing that you saw. There's none of that here.
Yeah, it's just here it is and you're experiencing it and maybe not. Yeah.
They're just shapes. It's like a patch of sky that looks slightly different to everything else.
Oh gosh, you know what it makes me think of? There's again thinking about music, there's this back in the day, Folk Alley, which was still is a channel online you can listen to it. They had this Folk Alley Halloween Scream stream, which I don't think is still going anymore, but I have tried to replicate it on Spotify with kind of trying to find all the tracks they had on it. But there's this song, I want to say it's from the 1970s by Linda Perhox. And I think that's how you say her name, but she has a song called Parallelograms. And it's just sort of psychedelic weirdness where she is just saying the names of shapes to kind of just bizarre music in the background. I highly recommend people go on to, you know, Spotify or your music catcher of choice and check it out, because it's just one of those things that doesn't kind of, you know, you can't really put it in a category now, but it gets played around sort of this time of year because it feels spooky. And it's kind of the same idea where it's just about shapes. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't fit anything, but I love that idea that there's these just shapes out there that could be a spooky thing, but we don't really know. So just recommend checking it out. Yeah, very weird stuff though. Excellent. Well, we should begin to wrap up in a minute or two, but any other good stories you think we should try to get people to dive into on this upcoming All Hallows Eve?
I'm wondering, so here, briefly, an acquaintance of mine owns a rectory, talking about Borley Rectory, the most famous haunted house in England. In somewhere on the West Cork Kerry border, a friend of mine, their family owns a Victorian rectory. It's a gorgeous building, about three stories tall, in this tiny little nothing of a village, which makes you wonder how the economics of that worked out, but right. Such was the case. And it's all restored, gorgeous Victorian furnishings, the whole bit. And the ghost story associated with it is that the rector murdered I think he murdered his mother. Oh. And he was a fairly young fellow, lived with the mother, murdered the mother. And if you stand in a room which is still to this day known as the ghost room, you can hear the sound of a ghostly horse and cart coming in the front, the front drive, but you see nothing. And interestingly, it's not the ghost of the person who was murdered. it's not even the ghost of the rector himself. It's the ghost of the cart coming in as the rector was coming back from the pub to do the dirty deed.
Oh.
And I just wonder if you guys have stories of phantom sounds, you know, that are the sound of something that you can't see. I wonder if that's a motif that appears in other places.
I do have one, and it's actually beer related. So it's amazing how I can just tie it all together. But again, this goes back to the Lemps, Lemp Brewing, you know, St. Louis, Missouri. Long not a going concern. Prohibition killed it as a business. But in the Lemp Mansion, when they were restoring it in the 1970s, one of the contractors insisted that he could hear in the, you know, kind of in the courtyard below his room, he could hear horses, you know, kind of walking around. He could hear carts, you know, basically going over cobblestones. And people were laughing at him, saying, well, it's all grass out there. There's no cobblestones. There's no horses. You're probably hearing the Anheuser-Busch Clydesdales from, you know, a few blocks away. And he's like, no, he insisted. There are horses there. I'm hearing them every morning, you know, kind of the same time of day. This persisted for weeks or months. And he finally quit, you know, kind of in anger that no one believed him, that he could hear these horses, you know, on some kind of cobbled pavement. And that summer it was dry and the grass started drying up in little squares, and they dug down and the whole cobbled yard was still there. And he apparently felt very vindicated. And then people found some photos of Elsa Lemp, who was known as the Lavender Lady, her horses, who she would have harnessed in lavender harness, and the whole carriage would be lavender. So just imagine the expense of that, would be, you know, harnessed up there every morning before she would go out to spend money in the early 1900s. And so I love that idea that, you know, the horses were kind of reappearing as a sound to someone, not to everyone, but to someone who was angry enough that no one was taking him seriously. So that's the one I know, kind of, where it's almost a phantom coach, and where again, and someone got to feel vindicated by it, which I think is a nice outcome. But I don't know, Christina, do you have one?
No, I don't have anything like that. No, I've definitely heard stories about, like, you know, a sound here and then nothing is there and something, but nothing like in particular is jumping out to me at the moment. I did, however, Google the black dog shelter adoption thing.
Oh, yeah.
And it appears that some of the studies say that there is a correlation between black dogs and higher rates of euthanasia or being surrendered. Oh. But other studies say the exact opposite, that it was actually more black dogs got adopted than others. So it seems like really context specific and really depends on the study and the years and all different things. So basically, I would say, based on all this, it's completely kind of inconclusive, and who knows? Because there's apparently been quite a few studies.
No, yeah. Absolutely. Well, but before we finish up, I do want to say, I know, Christina, you've got a list of interesting pubs and beers that tie into this whole kind of element. And if people are looking for something spooky, you may have some ideas for them.
Yeah, so it's a website, pintsandpubs.wordpress.com, and we'll link it. And they have an amazing article called Black Shuck, That Beer That Didn't Give a... and it's a list of, with some history as well, of different breweries and beers that are named after various black dogs and black dog sort of histories. And I think it's kind of really, really cool. So we'll link that. Some great sources as well in there. So you can see if you have any of these black dog beers located near you.
That cool. Sounds very, very cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I know. And I know we've been trying to like get like Morehouse's Black Cat or Pendle Witch's Brew over here in Ireland. And they're over in England, but they're hard to find here, which is kind of weird. But I know you can get them in the US. So if people are looking, they're out there. And I think, Kane, you were saying there's a supermarket beer somewhere that you used to get.
Oh my goodness. Yeah. When I lived in Essex, there was some cheap supermarket beer that had a black dog on the front. And he wasn't drawn with like scary glowing eyes or anything, but you could tell that it was trying to tie into that mythology somehow. So I'll see if I can track that down and you can put it in the notes.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So before we sign off and wish everyone a happy Halloween, any other stories you want to share or any other suggestions for people to kind of maybe go have their own vigil for this time of year? Mystery.
I don't.
Yeah, so maybe we do all need to just go to Killiki House and see if any hats get thrown at us. That could
That's a good place to start.
That could be interesting.
I mean, honestly, sounds like a handy ghost, like, to have around. Yeah. Maybe they can start throwing shoes.
Yeah, shoes, clothes. Slippers,
coats.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Never need to go shopping again. Oh, sounds, you know.
Yeah, not a bad thing. All right. Well, on that note, then I will say, first of all, thank you, Kian, for joining us. We love to have you. People, go and check out Wide Atlantic Weird if you're not subscribed already. There's some amazing, amazing stuff that I highly, highly recommend checking out. Really, really some good things. I think you've recently had on Bob Fisher talking about, you know, Haunted Generation and all that cool stuff. And like you said, Jeb Card with his spooky archaeology. And so some really good interviews, but also just deep dives on particular topics. And again, Irish High Strangeness, it's out there. So come and find out more about it. But again, we are at Beer Ladies Pod on all the socials. You can go to our link tree. We really, really appreciate you people who continue to like and share and subscribe. So thank you very much. And until next time, bye.
Bye.
Happy Halloween.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.